Hello, good evening. Thanks for coming. This is it's great to see everybody here. My name is Linda Ortenzo, for those of you who don't know me. I'm the director of STEM programs here at Carnegie Science Center, and STEM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. And I'm just very pleased to welcome you all here to Cafe Scientifique on behalf of our co-coordinators, Tim Palooka, who is the founder of Cafe Scientifique Pittsburgh, and Angela Strabilla. We have a really interesting program here tonight. Dr. Matthew Updike from Point Park University is going to talk about some really unique research in the area of environmental science. I was asking him about how often people really bring up the topic of lichens when they think about analyzing the environment and air quality, and he said not often. So tonight, we're going to be able to have some really expert party chat here and be kind of unique among our friends in the region, but it's an interesting topic. He's done fascinating research, and not only that, besides the presentation, he also brought some samples under the microscopes that he has here and some visual aids and things to pass around. So this is going to be a really great evening. And without any more delay, I would just invite you to help me welcome Dr. Matthew Updike.
All right, thank you. As Lyndon introduced me, I'm Matthew Updike from Point Park University. I've been teaching there as an assistant professor in the environmental program. I wanted to give you a little bit of background on how I got interested in lichens. About a couple of years ago, probably 3 years ago, a student came up to me and said, "What do you know about lichens?" I said, "Well, not much. I know they're a symbiotic organism. Its fungus and algae are involved in it." So we kind of put our heads together, thought up a research project, and applied to Pennsylvania DCNR, their Wild Resource Conservation Program. And we got some collaborators from the New York Botanical Garden, and we got the grant, lo and behold, and off we went on our research. The focus on our research was generally seeing if the distribution of lichens in the area could tell us anything about air quality, and also providing some baseline data. So there's very little in terms of what we know in species diversity of lichens in Pittsburgh. You know, the last study has been since the 1940s, and so it's been a long time since people have looked at lichens. Now, lichens is not a hot topic, as you can imagine. They don't run around. They're not furry. You can't pet them. But they're certainly fascinating because they're not as well known by many people. And so that sort of attracted me to the study of lichens. As was mentioned, if you get a chance after my talk, I have a display up here. You'll be able to look at the lichens on the microscope if you're interested. Also, I put my website up there. If you're interested in more on the research, you can go to the website and download more data. Our grant report is located on that website. For the presentation, I'm going to kind of split it into two parts. My first part is going to kind of identify what lichens are, some of their benefits in terms of ecology and even economics, and then get into more of the research of what I've done in terms of air quality and lichens and their connection. So what is a lichen? Lichen essentially means leprous in Greek. The Greeks originally thought that lichens looked like the skin of people with leprosy. And so that's sort of where it started off in terms of looking at these particular organisms. I'd like to point out that lichens are not plants. Sometimes in the newspapers, you'll notice the reference of lichens to plants. So lichens are not plants. They're an organism of actually two different kingdoms. You know, we base our classification of living organisms on five kingdoms based on the Linnaeus system. And so you've got your plants, your animals, your monera, which are bacteria, your protista, like amoebas, and then you have your fungi. So the lichens are actually fungi and algae, so two different groups of organisms or kingdoms in this sense. It's a composite organism of both the fungus. The most common type of fungus is what we call the stack fungi. So these stack fungi, and you've got your photobuoyant. The photobuoyant is typically either your green algae or your cyanobacteria. So those are your two most common types of photobuoyants. The photobuoyant is essentially the organism that produces carbohydrates, you know, through photosynthesis. And so through that provides food for the fungus. The fungus, on the other hand, will provide the supply of moisture as well as providing protection for that algae. The one way I like to explain what lichens are is that it's essentially fungus that has identified agriculture. Right? They've tested fungus and or lichens, have separated out the fungal and the algal partners to see if they would live on their own. Algae do perfectly well on their own, but the fungus tends to suffer for survival. So in that sense, the fungus is actually taking more advantage of the algae than vice versa. The algae don't need the fungus for survival. We call that a type of symbiotic relationship commensalism. Commensalism is where one organism benefits and the other one doesn't really care one way or the other. So in this case, algae doesn't really care so much. Just to point out sort of the picture I have up here, the photobuoyant is kind of that green layer that you see. This is a piece of lichen that's been cut. The surface of that lichen is what we call the cortex, and that's sort of where the colorations occur in that cortex. Then you'll see sort of two whitish layers that border the algal layer, and so that's actually the fungal hyphae, the filaments of the fungus. So if you cut into a mushroom, you can actually see the filaments of a mushroom. All right, so what is not a lichen? Well, one confusion with lichens is bryophytes. Bryophytes are either mosses or liverworts. Mosses, though, and I'll pass around a couple examples. The first example is just general species of lichens on a stick. Nothing too exciting. But all of these sticks are from, in this area, Schenley and Frick Park. And so you'll get some idea of what a lichen is just based on these samples. The other examples I'll pass around in petri dishes are bryophytes. So the bryophytes are your mosses. If you look at the petri dishes closely, you can actually see stems and leaves. Right? And so that's how you differentiate between mosses and your lichens. Lichens don't have stems and leaves. So. Another confusion oftentimes is with algae. Right? So algae might look a bit like lichen in some forms. So for that case, you actually have to look under a microscope to differentiate between the two. I'll pass around. Yeah, that one too. Are you guys a sample of lichen there? All right, so there are three main forms of lichens that we can see. We have the foliose lichens, we have what are called fruticose lichens, and then we have what are called crustose lichens. The foliose lichens have two easily distinguishable sides. The samples that are passed around on the sticks, those are foliose lichens. And so if you kind of peel them up a little bit, you can actually see an underside as well. So they have two distinguishable sides. The entire structure of the lichen we call a thallus. It kind of looks like essentially a leaf stuck to the side of a tree. They can be flat and leafy-like, like lettuce in these pictures, or they can be convoluted and full of ridges and bumps and all sorts of different sizes. So foliose, though, are probably the most distinguishable. In other words, that's what you first see when you look at a tree. Another type is fruticose. Fruticose we don't have as abundant in this area as if you go to either up in Canada or if you go even to the West Coast, like Oregon or Washington. This is where you really get to see the beautiful fruticose lichens. Fruticose lichens can be pendant and hair-like. If you've ever seen that hanging, sort of those hanging pendant lichens, we call those beard lichens. You really get to see some beautiful samples in Oregon. You can also have upright, shrubby, or cup-like, and like some of these examples here. The one in the bottom, sort of lower picture, anybody know what example that might be? It's probably the most common example of a fruticose of reindeer lichen. So reindeer lichen, you go up into Canada, and caribou, reindeer, hence its name, often feed on these types of lichens. So fruticose tend to be more shrubby in appearance versus the foliose, which is more flat. And then we have crustose lichens. Crustose lichens, you can almost think of it as someone painting the side of a tree. You know? So it looks a little bit like algae painted on the side of a tree as well, so you almost need a microscope. But crustose lichens only have an upper surface. And if you try and take a crustose off of a tree, you're most likely going to take some of that tree with you. You know, whereas the foliose, you could peel it off the tree without damaging the tree. Crustose, you're probably going to damage the tree as well. These are a couple examples up here. The one on the left-hand side, this is what's called a fluffy dust. So I'll use the common names as I go through the lichen because they're more interesting. Things like candle flame and fluffy dust, monk's hood. A lot more interesting than the species name, scientific name. We'll find fluffy dust all over the Pittsburgh area. It's more of a light bluish coloration. You see it on rocks, you'll see it on trees. Another example that on the bottom picture is called script lichen. Script lichen gets its name because it's sort of the little swirly marks. It looks like worms. But you really won't see script lichen in the Pittsburgh area. You have to go to somewhere like Forbes State Forest. And you want to look at the very base of those trees in wetlands, you know, wherever it's a very wet habitat. The one on the far right is called a rim lichen. So rim lichens are pretty common around here. But to differentiate rim lichen from the other types of crustose, you can sort of see these cup-like little appendages. This is the far right-hand picture. And so that's the fruiting body of the fungus, actually. So, as I go through as well, I'll pass around some more samples. The samples I'll pass around first are our fruticose samples. So these kind of samples are going to be very shrubby. These are all samples that you're going to find around Allegheny, Washington, Westmoreland counties. So they're going to be in this region of western Pennsylvania. In some cases, you won't see them in the Pittsburgh downtown area, but you know, you'll see them particularly in the surrounding counties. All right, so identifying lichens. You know, you're out in the woods looking at these lichens on the side of trees. How do you identify? Well, we just learned how to identify the three different groups. All right, the easy way to remember it is foliose, you can peel it off. You know, crustose, you can't peel it off the bark. And then the shrubby-like ones are going to be your fruticose ones. For identification, we essentially start off with the color, the shape, and the size of those lichens. By the way, the petri dishes I'm passing around, if you look on the edges, you'll see the scientific and the common names, so in case you're interested. All right, so a lot of times I get questions from friends saying, I've got a tree in my backyard, and it's covered with lichens. It looks horrible. Is it killing the tree? You know, so one thing to point out is that lichens are not killing the tree. You know, they're not extracting any nutrients. They're not extracting any water from that tree. Now, there have been studies that have shown that lichens attached to rocks or statues, they do release an acid that will slowly, over long periods of time, we're saying decades, it will dissolve the minerals from that rock structure. But there's been nothing shown that it does any damage to the trees. And in fact, it's a good thing because it shows good air quality. Right? So the more lichens you have, the better the air quality, because these are very sensitive to air quality changes. Yeah. I wouldn't really necessarily call it acidic base because there are some lichens that, yes, you could say that. Beard lichen has eucinic acid, but not all lichen species are the same. Yes, and so are a lot of lichens. In fact, most lichens are edible. So.
Talking about acidic secretion, when the lichens release acidic secretion, they release the minerals which benefit the plants.
Yes.
The minerals are taken up by the plants. And they help the plants to grow. So there is some sort of a symbiotic, mutualistic relationship also.
Yes.
Between the fungus and the plants.
Yes, and I'll get to her question in a second. She was talking about the relationship between lichens and other plants. So I was just, so far, just talking about algae and fungus. But I'll approach that question later in my talk. But to identify them, one of the key characteristics is going to be color, particularly with your folios. You see two different types here, common green shield all over Pittsburgh, mealy rosette, more of a grayish color is the mealy rosette. The greenish one is green shield. Shape and size also is going to tell us. You know, the lobes are much larger for green shield, much thinner for the mealy rosette. So that's one of the easiest ways to start identifying. Then we can look at the rhizines. Now, for the folios, if you lift up the underside of that lichen, you'll see these sort of appendages. They look like roots, but they're not roots. Right? Lichens are not transporting nutrients or water into their structure. All they are attachments to that substrate. So some of them have different colors. You have more of a pale white versus a dark coloration, or some are more branched and some are singular. So that helps us identify. Another lichen here is showing what's called cilia. So on the very edges of the lobes, you know, it looks like little rhizines that are poking out along those edges. We call those cilia. This is called a powdered ruffle lichen. We can find these in North Park. Or I've seen them in North Park. It looks like newspaper that you take up and crumple and stick it to the side of a tree. So they're pretty easy to identify, those powdered ruffle lichens. Other ways to identify is their fruiting bodies. So some lichens are sterile. They don't produce these fruiting bodies, but we call these ascomata. I want to point out that this is lichen, the fungal partner. You know, so these bunch of different forms, you see the script lichen, the black lines, that's the ascomata. More visual in terms of the top pictures, though. All right, and so this is where millions of spores are being released. But the fungi that are being released in terms of the spores, they're on their own. You know, they got to find their own algal partners. You know, their spores do not include their algal partner. So that means that when they are dispersed to the environment and attached to a tree, they have to find their own partner. Yeah.
When the spores are released, the fungal spores, there isn't a chance of accidentally inhaling the fungal spores. And when it enters the lungs, it can cause fungal infection in the lung. So how do you prevent your investigators from getting infected with fungal spores?
For the concentration, the question was, if you inhale the fungal spores, how do we protect our students in terms of through that inhalation? The concentration you would receive is so low, it's minimal. And so it's negligent in terms of any damages to respiratory problems. Another way we can identify our lichens is by the vegetative reproductive structures. You know, so this means that lichens, the fungi can reproduce, but if you have these reproductive structures called ceridia, that means that enclosed in both of those is your fungus plus your algal partner. So during the rain, it might break off some of these parts, and each one of those parts can then grow into a new lichen. So there are two types. You have ceridia and isidia. The isidia are finger-like projections. And you can kind of see that in the upper picture. And then the ceridia are kind of the whitish dots that you almost see on the one lichen here on the picture. So both of those, you know, the presence or absence, that is also going to help us sort of identify our lichens as well. In addition, other ways to identify them is through thin layer chromatography. So if you get a chance to look at up here at a later time, what we can do is take a fungus and essentially break down the sample and then allow that sort of sample to dissolve through alcohol, and it separates out the substances. And the presence or absence of various organic substances help us identify the species as well. This is particularly useful for Krustos lichens because they're probably the hardest to identify. You really have to use chemical analyses to separate out those Krustos forms. So. All right, so more into the nitty-gritty. So what are the ecological role of lichens? One of the ecological roles is that they're nature's pioneers, you know, for those barren sites. You know, say you have a volcanic eruption on the Hawaiian Islands. The area is pretty much barren except for a few organisms that can survive those conditions. Lichens are ubiquitous, as I said. You can find them in the Arctic. You can find them in the driest deserts. You know, they're pretty well adaptable for a variety of conditions. One of the benefits is their ability to undergo desiccation, which means that they can completely dry out almost and survive, like this species, for up to 62 weeks without rainfall. Then once it gets wet, you know, it essentially springs to life again and it starts to photosynthesize. The algae begins to photosynthesize. So that sort of benefits and allow these lichens to survive under extreme conditions. Also, you can have soil and a variety of dust being trapped by these lichens, and so over long periods of time, you can develop a soil layer with the help of these lichens. So they can sort of provide that benefit as the pioneers for a new area. And now approaching one of the questions that was addressed was essentially what help do lichens do to surrounding plants? Right, and so for these, if you have lichens that with the cyanobacteria component, right, and so that's part of that photobuoyant, these cyanobacteria can fix nitrogen, which means that they take nitrogen from the environment, which is two nitrogen atoms bound together, and they break that nitrogen atom apart or molecule apart, and then they produce nitrate from that. Right, so those nitrates can then go on for feeding other plants, you know, mosses in the nearby area, liverworts in the nearby area. And so that's one benefit that lichens can serve for other plants. So you have also a relationship not just within the lichen, but also between its partners surrounding it, like plants and stuff. In this particular sample example, this is dog pelt lichen. Won't see it in this area. You might see it up in Canada, more the northern states. But if you notice the black spots, that's actually where cyanobacteria is undergoing nitrogen fixation. And so that's sort of an extreme case of where you can actually see that cyanobacteria component. They can also provide food. Right? And so ungulates, things like moose, things like deer, mountain goats, you know, all of those we know feed off of lichen. And in fact, 90% of the winter diet of caribou and reindeer, they rely on lichens. You know, lichens provide a lot of good resources for carbohydrates. You know, they're rich in carbohydrates because of the algae, but they're very poor in protein. And so these ungulates have to find their protein source elsewhere. But they do at least provide some winter food for these caribou and reindeer. And as I mentioned, reindeer lichen, and I'll pass around a sample from Canada, reindeer lichen is a major source for these animals. There was also a study done in West Virginia, and they found that 80% of spring and summer diet of flying squirrels was on lichens, you know, which was surprising to me. So this is more of a local case. But flying squirrels have also been found to use lichens for their nests as well. And then arthropods, a variety of springtails, bugs, that kind of stuff, will also feed off of lichens. So we know that they provide that important food source as well. And of course, we know that they're nesting material for birds. Even our hummingbird uses lichens in some cases for their nests. About 50 different species we found use lichens for their nesting habitat. And these are kind of interesting. There's even some organisms that will use lichens for camouflage. One of the coolest ones, I think, is lacewing larva. This is the picture on the left-hand side. It just looks like a lichen stuck to the side of a tree. But what it is this lacewing. He attaches, essentially, a piece of lichen to its back, and it provides perfect camouflage for it. You know, I mean, if you were a bird, would you know that that was a bug underneath that? I know I wouldn't, but... another one that's more local is the green salamander. These are down in Maryland. They've evolved so that their coloration on their backs match the Cladonia-type lichens, which is a fruticose type. So that allows them to sort of hide within within the lichens without being picked off by predators. So lichens play a lot of ecological benefits that sometimes we don't hear about. And even they have some economical roles. You might think, well, that's nice. I'm glad they play ecological roles. But what good are they in terms of commercialism or any kind of economical benefits for us? But they do provide some. And in fact, we used to use lichens for making alcohol. This was early back in the 1800s, though. They did try it commercially in Sweden, but apparently didn't take off too well. So they're no longer doing it. But they did try it in Mexico. A couple of monasteries in Siberia also used to make alcohol using lichens, but apparently wasn't too good. Horsehair lichens, you'll find these in the western part of the U.S. Some of our native populations will eat horsehair lichens. They tend to be baked, used in soups, puddings, or making taffy. From what I've heard, they kind of have the texture and taste of black licorice. So I didn't have any samples I could bring to try you guys, but I'm sure they're pretty yummy. Rock tripe, has anyone been to Japan? Or if you ever get a chance to go to Japan, look for rock mushroom. So rock mushroom is a type of lichen in the picture that's very rich in vitamin C, but it's also a delicacy in Japan. And so there are some cases of commercialized use of lichens. And even manna lichen, which is certainly interesting. Manna lichen has been thought to have once been the biblical manna eaten by Israelites in the Sinai wilderness. Manna lichen essentially starts out as little pebbles in the soil. Over time, winds will blow this manna lichen together into large clumps. And then in the morning dew, it rises like loaves of bread. There are desert tribes that will feed on manna lichen even today for a food source during drought conditions. So there's a lot of kind of unique history in terms of using lichens in terms of economy. We can even get dyes. We can get perfumes and decorations as well from these lichens. In terms of medicines, there's a There's a species called a beard lichen. We do have beard lichen in Pennsylvania, though you have to go more to central Pennsylvania to find it. It does require good air quality conditions. But beard lichen has eucinic acid in it, and that eucinic acid has been found to have antibiotic properties. And so, you know, it's been commercialized in Europe, but not here in the U.S. So if you wanted eucinic acid as an antibiotic, kind of have to go to Europe. So, another thing is interesting is that lichens have also been used for poisons. There's a species called wolf lichen you'll find in the western part of the U.S. It gets its name because it's poisonous, and ranchers used to use it to poison the wolves. But there are very few lichens that are actually poisonous, which means that if you're lost in the woods, it's a safe bet you could probably eat the lichens for food. And if your interest is in perfumes, you can even find a lichen for perfume. It's called oak moss lichen, and we do have this in the U.S. as well. I won't try to pronounce the name, but it looks like a French perfume. And, of course, probably the most common use of lichens we see in decorations of our train displays. So those are very widespread, and any kind of hobby shop will carry those species. All right, so now getting down to sort of my research component and primary interest, you know, how can we use these as indicators of air quality? As I said, lichens tend to be very widespread. We can find them pretty much all over the place. However, there's a lot of different species. You know, we're talking hundreds of species, you know, particularly in the U.S. So all those species, with all those species, some of them are sensitive to poor air quality, and some are more tolerant. So those that are more sensitive are those that are going to have the cyanobacteria as the photoboyant, like the beard lichen that's being passed around. Those that are more tolerant tend to be like that fluffy dust lichen. That tends to be a very tolerant type of lichen. So just looking at that species diversity kind of gives us an idea of air quality in the region. All right. And so they're variable to sensitivity in these, in terms of research that's been done, I should point out, these three compounds, the sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and ozone, there's been most studies done on linking that to lichens. And also, there's been some studies trying to connect lichens to urbanization, effects of urbanization. Particularly in Cincinnati, there was a study in the metropolitan area that was trying to link the lichen distribution to automobiles, you know, the frequency of automobiles. So they were able to draw conclusions from that. One thing I want to point out with these two pictures I have up here, same exact species. This is a fruticose lichen. The one on the left-hand side is from Mingo Creek Park. Mingo Creek Park is in Washington County. It's about an hour and a half south of here. If you look at the one on the right-hand side, same species, but it's from Schenley Park. All right, so very distinct, though, in terms of that ascomata, that reproductive structure. Right? They show up a lot during that Mingo Creek, but you walk around Schenley, you walk around Frick Park, you'll see the same species, but you won't see those structures. And so that kind of tells us an indication right there in terms of air quality. Right? And so it gives us an indication that air quality may not be as good here than it is in the rural areas. So. All right, so when we developed our study, we chose four main sites to concentrate our work on. We chose to look in the interior of Pittsburgh, the metropolitan area. We looked at Schenley and Frick Park, and then we chose two rural parks that included Mingo, which is in Washington County, and then Roaring Runs, which is in Forbes State Forest. So Roaring Runs is over in Westmoreland County. It's kind of in the lower corner there. Just giving you an idea, in terms of population size, based on U.S. Census reports, about 1,500 per square mile surrounding Schenley and Frick in terms of population, about 20 million per square mile. Wait, did I get that right? Sorry, 20 persons per square mile around Mingo and Roaring Runs. So obviously very different in that sense. In terms of transportation use, about 200 million miles traveled per year around Schenley and Frick compared to about 10 million miles traveled per year around Mingo and Roaring Runs. So obviously difference in terms of urban areas and rural areas. Size of the parks, Mingo and Roaring Runs is about 10 times the size of that of Shenley and Frick, so much larger in size. Just a little bit of background in air quality for the Pittsburgh region. This is just data that comes from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, so their air monitoring stations. It just ranges from 1997 to 2006. Right? And I've got three different sites here. Pittsburgh, which is actually right here at the Carnegie Science Center, is where this data comes from. Charleroi, it's about 9 miles away from Mingo Creek. And then Greensburg, which is about 20 miles from Roaring Run's natural area. If we look at the graphs, I chose four different ambient air quality standards to look at. Particulate matter, ozone, sulfur dioxide, and then nitrogen dioxide. The horizontal bar, that's the levels for the National Ambient Air Quality Standards that's been set by the Environmental Protection Agency. All right, so what this essentially shows, that in the last 10 or so years, Pittsburgh's doing pretty good with sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxides. Right, and so that has a lot to do with the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments and also the acid rain program. And so we saw a decline in both sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide because of that. Much of that sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide, they come from the Ohio River Valley. So there's not a whole lot Pittsburgh can do about that. If I concentrate on the nitrogen dioxide, right, this is the only graph that really shows a difference between Pittsburgh and the other two sites. Right, and so we do see actually a higher concentration in Pittsburgh compared to the other two sites, and that's probably due to transportation. The major source of nitrogen dioxide, at least on the East Coast, is going to be from transportation. And so greater abundance of cars mean higher concentrations of nitrogen dioxide coming out the tailpipes. On the upper two graphs, particulate matter and ozone, we do have a bit of problems with that. In fact, if you remember 2009, the American Lung Association ranked us as the worst city in terms of short-term particulate matter. We even exceeded Los Angeles. So, but we can see we have problems with ozone as well as that particulate matter. And so we know that we don't have the cleanest of air quality, although we've certainly cleaned up quite a bit since the industrial era. All right, so going back to our study, so after we chose those four sites, we would take each of those parks and divide them into six equal quadrants. We would then go into each of those quadrants and survey the entire area within that quadrant. And we would look for an interior forest location that had the greatest abundance of lichens. Right? So we had to have some criteria that we would allow us to compare those different sites. All right, so we chose the interior of the forest because we didn't want to have that impact from recreation, from fertilizers and open areas, or along roadsides where you'd have a lot of transportation. So that's why we chose the interior part of the park. Once we found that area that had the greatest lichen concentration, we would then look at the red oak trees. Now, different trees have different bark chemistries. Something like black cherry tends to be more acidic. Red oak trees tend to be more basic in terms of their pH, and lichens prefer that basic pH. So we concentrate on red oak trees, and we use this microplot, which is like a little grid, and we would set it on each of the sides of the tree, the north, south, east, and west, at two different heights. And this would allow us to sort of generate an estimate of percentage in terms of coverage by the lichens and what species were present. In addition, once we did the microplot study on one tree, we would then extend our plot size to 5,000 square feet, and we'd essentially sample all the trees and look for the lichen distribution on all trees then. We also did transplants. I won't talk about that too much, but we took samples from Mingo Creek and transplanted them to Shenley. We want to look at growth rates. But lichens grow at a rate of about 2 to 5 centimeters a year, so it's kind of hard to look at those growth rates in only a period of 1 year. You really need longer time periods. And then finally, we also did the park-wide species diversity. So we hiked these essentially parks up and down looking for all different species of lichens. We were only looking at lichens attached to trees. So these are what we call epiphytic lichens. Right? So we weren't looking at any of the rock lichens. All right, so some of the data I wanted to show you was looking at the dominant community of lichens that we found. Dominant species, first one's fluffy dust. You can find that all over Schenley and Frick, and that probably really jumps out at you if you see them alongside the old bridges and stuff. That's more of a light bluish, kind of silverish kind of color almost. There's another one that looks somewhat like it. We call that sterile crustose because we don't actually know the species of that. And this one is more of a mint greenish coloration. And that picture, I guess, didn't come out too well, but it's a side-by-side picture with the fluffy dust on the left-hand side. Another one that's very common around this area is the smooth-footed powderhorn. And so this is a fruticose lichen, so it fits in sort of a what's called a cladonia group of lichens. These are very common. Particularly if you look on the base of the trees at Frick and Schenley, you'll see a lot of this powderhorn around. It's a very common lichen. In terms of our species diversity survey, we came up with 46 different species of epiphytic lichens. Right, about 33 species at Mingo Creek and Roaring Runs, and about 20 different species at Schenley and Frick. So clearly, greater diversity in those rural parks. Crustose, in terms of the crustose types, the most common species, fluffy dust and sterile crustose. And then the most common for folios, or common green shield, pretty easy to find because it's pretty much the only greenish folios lichen in this area. Hammered shield, mealy rosette, rough speckled shield, and powdered speckled shield. And so you can almost identify them based on their names. Hammered shield, it looks like someone essentially has taken a piece of metal and taken a hammer to and just pounded away at it. So it has a lot of convoluted ridges and stuff. Looks very more grayish, I guess you can say. Mealy rosette looks more like a rosette picture, a rosette flower or something. In terms of the most common fruticose forms, it was that cladonia, so that powderhorn. But we came up with 46 different species. To sort of compare our data among our parks, we use what's called the lichen diversity value. There's a lot more research and connection with lichens and air quality that's being done in Europe than in the U.S. U.S. is kind of behind in terms of about a decade or so in terms of what's Europe, in terms of what Europe is doing right now. But they developed in England this lichen diversity value to sort of compare the frequency of lichens at various sites. And so this is a statistical value that compares that frequency, and it identifies the presence of environmental stress. Now, in areas in Europe where you have high lichen diversity, this value is going to be about 40 to 80, just to give you a comparison. So even our Roaring Runs and Mingo, our rural parks, they don't even get up to that range. So it definitely tells us that even out in those outer areas like Forbes State Forest, there's still an impact to probably air quality. One thing to note, we noticed that Frick actually is the lowest of all. If you visit Schenley and Frick, you notice that Schenley is managed as more of an open park. Frick is managed as more of a denser park system. And so lichens prefer sunlight. They got to have sunlight. And so if you manage your parks as more of an open area, that's going to give you greater diversity and abundance of lichens. So that's why we sort of see that difference between Schenley and Frick. But we do see rural with greater abundance as well as diversity. This is the data looking at the aerial plots. So as I said, after we did our micro plots on one tree, we would then extend our plots further outward. So these aerial plots, we looked at all the trees in that plot. I'm only throwing three different examples up here. Black cherry, red oak, and sugar maple. So black cherry tends to have more acidic bark. And so that means if you've got a forest with black cherry trees and that's the only species you have, you probably aren't going to have very much lichen. It's just not going to be able to survive on those bark. Sugar maple and red oak have more basic bark chemistry in terms of their pH. So that's going to have probably greater diversity. And you can see that in the numbers. The numbers on the left-hand side are part of a category that defines the percent coverage, total percent coverage on those trees. So it's actually an average across the urban and rural sites is what we're looking at. In parentheses, that's the standard error. So one thing to look at is the differences in trees. Right? Black cherry clearly has less. Also, in terms of comparing the rows, urban versus rural, rural has a greater percentage of lichens in terms of their abundance. In addition, what's kind of interesting is in the urban park, you see a greater percentage in the crustos than in the other types. Right? Those crustos forms that we found, the fluffy dust, those are very tolerant of poor air quality conditions. You know, and so that was pretty much the only species we came across. Versus the rural, you know, we see a shift from the most dominant being squamulose. Squamulose is another subcategory of that fruticose. And so, again, that's that powder horn. You know, a lot of that is that powder horn lichen. But those squamulose are more sensitive to air quality conditions than the crustos, and that's why we're sort of seeing that shift occur between the urban and the rural parks. All right, so what does this tell us? You know, so I threw a couple results at you. You know, what's the big picture? You know, what's going on here? First of all, the Pittsburgh region is dominated by nitrogen and sulfur dioxide tolerant species. Now, you go out to even Forbes State Forest, and you're going to be hard-pressed to find any lichens that have cyanobacteria as their photobuoyant. So that means that we're pretty much widespread in terms of our sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide pollutants. You know, we can't really get away from that because it comes from the Ohio River Valley for the most part, as well as the Great Lakes region. These are the dominant species that we see in this area. You know, we already kind of mentioned these, but the green shield, the hammered shield, rosette lichens, and also the shadow lichens. I'll pass around a couple examples of the shadow lichens. They're not really exciting, but what is unique about one of them is this called orange cord shadow lichen. And it's the only lichen in this region which, instead of having a white fungal inside the lichen, it's actually orangish in color. So it's really cool and easy to identify. These lichens you'll find more the interior of a forest. So these are more abundant in Frick Park, especially if you get back in the woods there. There was a study that was done in 1966 by Brodo, and he was looking at lichens on Long Island, New York. He essentially identified sort of the broader area that when you step back and look at a broad region, that the distribution of lichens is predominantly defined by air quality conditions. But if you zoom in on one of those areas, then you're going to have what's called this city effect. And that city effect he identified as being humidity levels or temperature levels. Right? So that in an urban area where we take out a lot of our trees, those trees will transport the water from the soil through their roots, shoots, and then out through their leaves. We call that evapotranspiration. And so that adds moisture to the environment, and also it leads to a cooling process. Also, we have waste heat being developed in urban areas. We have asphalt that absorbs the sunlight. And so all this is going to raise temperature levels in the city. And so you have this sort of city effect taking place that lowers humidity levels and raises temperatures in the city compared to rural areas. And so what we're seeing in our study is that we're seeing overall the impact of this sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide pollution. And it kind of defines the general types of species in the area. However, when we're comparing rural versus urban parks, we're seeing this city effect. Right? We're seeing this limitation due to lower humidity concentrations in urban areas. Just to rehash, lichen diversity in rural parks, almost twice that we found in the urban parks. And then that lichen diversity value, almost twice that again, suggesting that lichens are under higher stress in our urban areas. Another point to make is that going back to this management of parks, if you ever look at younger trees, more smoother bark, particularly sugar maples, very smooth bark, that's not beneficial for lichens. You know, they prefer those older trees that have those ridges, so that way they can disperse and colonize in those ridges and grow. And so even a younger forest versus an older forest, you're going to see differences in your lichen distribution. Comparing our study to some previous studies that have been done, if you look at studies around the Northeast, you'll find that the exact same species we have in Pittsburgh, you're going to find in New York City. You know, you're going to find in Chicago, or well, I guess that's more Midwest, but you'll find similar ones in Chicago and Cincinnati. Those include the mealy rosette, the hammered shield, the rough speckled shield, star rosette, and candle flame. All of these you might see on the sides of trees at Frick or Schenley. On the picture to the far left here, The fluffy dust, again, that's sort of that bluish one. The yellowish one is actually a foliose, but so small you can't see the lobes of that lichen. So you need a microscope almost. But that's what we call candle flame. And I've seen a lot of that candle flame, especially along the old walls and stuff around Schenley Park. So it's very distinctive in terms of that yellow coloration. Almost looks like someone took a paintbrush and just kind of smeared the side of the wall. We also see it on the trees, of course. And then finally, some other studies have been done. So we provide, or our research has done sort of, you can think of it as one point of study, right? But that doesn't tell us a whole lot. We really can't differentiate right now between air pollution and urbanization. Right? What we have to do is a long-term study, and that's going to provide our solid answers to that question. So we're just starting out. We're providing that baseline data. In another 10 years, we're going to continue this study and then be able to develop a stronger emphasis on what's more of an impact on these lichens or if there's been any changes to air quality. There's been a study by McClenahan. He published in 2007. This is in Indiana County, Pennsylvania. And he saw that between 1997 and 2003, actually an increase in lichens of 0.56 species per year. Now, that's after the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, as well as the acid rain program, where we had improvements in the terms of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide. Right? So he's seeing a response to that in terms of improving air quality. But if we go back further in time, we see a different picture. Wetmore did a study in the Cayuga Valley National Recreation Area. This is in Ohio. He was looking at lichens today compared to back to the 1800s. And he sees that there's a 79% loss of lichens in that period. And so that certainly says that there is an impact in air quality as well as urbanization playing a role affecting the presence and absence of these lichens. In terms of our data, for this region, there's a study done and published in 1948 by Mozingo. And our results are similar to what Wetmore found, so about a 69% loss of lichens in western Pennsylvania area. Now, to be fair, this Mozingo study, he didn't identify any of the locations he actually found the lichens in. All we know is that he collected them out of southwestern Pennsylvania. And so that's the best we can sort of compare to. Another thing is that some of the species he identified was clearly misidentified, and their ranges do not occur in Pennsylvania. And so we did account for that in this percentage that you're seeing. But there are some species that are very easy to identify. And so it would be hard to say that he made a mistake in identifying things like lungwort or flat-fruited pell. Both of these, their ranges do overlap in Pennsylvania, and these have cyanobacteria as their photobuoyant. And so that means that they're very sensitive to lichens. We no longer see them in southwestern Pennsylvania. In fact, I'm yet to see them in Pennsylvania yet. And so I guess that wraps up my presentation. Are we going to wait questions later? Or?
Well, let's thank Dr. Updike for his talk.
Okay.
Very informative. And our tradition here is to take a 10 to 15 minute break. So please take a break and come back for Q&A in about 10 minutes. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, folks. We're back again. Welcome back for the Q&A session. If you have a question, please raise your hand, and Angela and I will be running around like crazy with microphones ready to hand them to you. And we'll race to see who gets there first.
I have a triple-pronged question.
Okay.
How old are lichens and the family of lichens, and when did they evolve? And are they still evolving? And this, the last one's about rain. The rain that we've had for the last 3 months is really unusual. And how do differences in climate affect lichens?
Okay, in terms of the age of lichens, that's harder to, I'll take that hard question first. We have bacteria dating back 3.5 billion years or so, cyanobacteria. And so that means that the photobullient probably evolved first in terms of those lichens. Now, the fungal partner came on the scene most likely prior to the plants, particularly angiosperms and gymnosperms. So that probably means that it's hard to pin. I can't pinpoint any particular date down, but they're definitely older than the angiosperms, the flowering plants, like tomatoes and stuff. I think that's probably the best I can tell in terms of the age, because it is a symbiotic organism. You know, we can kind of separate the individual partners out, but in terms of the organism itself, it's kind of a harder question to answer. I don't know if I can get to that one good. The other question I probably could answer a lot better in terms of what can they tell us about the climate. This green shield lichen, in Denmark there has been a study trying to look at climate change in association with that green shield lichen. So green shield lichen are more of a temperate versus subtropical species. And so they're looking at the migration northward of that species, and they're seeing it migrating northward, clearly an indication of climate change because lichens can't get up and run around and move northward. And so it's going to be more of a slow progression. So they are using them in terms of climate change. In terms of more frequent rainfall, we're probably not going to see a rapid growth of lichens due to high spring rains. Lichens only grow 2 to 5 centimeters a year. You know, and so we're not going to really see a response due to one particular year being more rainy, the other one being more dry. What you might see, though, is that lichens would be much more desiccated, much more drier during a drought year. And so they might be more crumbly. So in that sense, you know, because they're more easier to break, they may not survive as well in those drought conditions. So birds rubbing against them, animals clawing the trees, bears or something, that would break up the lichens more and they would have a harder time surviving in that sense. But did that answer your question okay?
I just wanted to, first of all, reinforce what I think you said earlier, is that although they are on trees, they are not like a parasite to the tree. They do not eat the tree per se. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. I was just wondering, is there any possibility of isolating other environmental factors other than air pollution, maybe the chemistry of the soils and things around it that would affect the results, and therefore is there any... Would that be a possibility of showing up in the results of your surveys? And how would you isolate the effects accordingly?
Yeah, I didn't show all the data for our aerial plots in terms of percent lichen coverage by species of trees. But we clearly saw differences due to bark chemistry, and we measured the bark chemistry of those trees. Black cherry, pH ranges from 0 to 14, so anything less than 7 is acidic. Black cherry bark has a pH of around 6 to 6.5. Red oak and sugar maples, their pH is more neutral, so it's around 7 or so. And we did see a clear correlation with greater lichen coverage on those more basic trees in terms of bark chemistry. And so those more acidic trees like black cherry had much less in terms of coverage. So we can separate it by that factor. In terms of the air, well, I guess you want to get away from air quality. I'm trying to think of another example. another correlation would be good. In terms of soil, certainly you can compare soil characteristics. More acidic soils, which you find in bogs, you'll find a lot of sphagnum moss. Sphagnum moss actually generates some of that acidity. And so you're less likely to see lichens in those conditions where it's very acidic, you know, pH down around 4 or 5. So that would be almost the pH of lemon juice, which is about 3, I guess. And so lichens, though, in areas where you have more basic conditions, you go out to the Midwest, you know, you're more likely to see lichens distributed throughout those forests, the soils, because of those more basic soils. You go up into the boreal forest where you have more pine trees, so in the soil, the conditions are a bit more acidic. You know, you only find a few species of lichens that are adapted for those acidic conditions like reindeer lichen. Right? And so we can see correlations with soil chemistry as well as bark chemistry.
Question over here.
How does your project fit in with the Point Park University curriculum? How does it involve undergraduates, and what is it, a course, or what kind of credit do they get, or is it extra, or how does it fit into your teaching?
Oh, cool. So, right when I started off, I really got interested in this project because of a student. So the student came to me and said, "I want to do this project. It looks really cool with lichens." I had, over the course of about, I guess, 2 or 3 years, I had about a total of 3 or 4 students involved. And they were working with me on independent studies. And so through those independent studies, you know, they got to publish, they got to present at the Pennsylvania Academy of Sciences and even the International Ecological Society of America meetings. So it really benefits a lot of the undergraduate students at Point Park University. In addition, what's nice is I can bring this research into the classroom. I teach botany and ecology, and so I can engage students with lichens, you know, in those classes with all these samples and discussions and stuff. So, you know, a lot of students have been brought into this project and have benefited from it. We have a publication hopefully coming out soon in the Pennsylvania Academy of Sciences. Several students are listed on that. Not only that, but our collaborations with the DCNR and as well as the New York Botanical Gardens. Those students got to work with those people as well. So.
We have another question over here.
I was just wondering, you talked all about lichen on trees. Have you done, or anyone else done, like on other things, like you said, rocks? It's found on many other things than just trees.
In this area, no. Now, essentially, rock lichen are harder to identify because most of the types are Krustos lichens. And to identify them, the species, you really need to do chemical analyses like that thin layer chromatography I was talking about. However, there is a guy, James Lendemeer, from the Botanical Gardens. And he's essentially working his way across the state, starting on the eastern side. And so right now, I think he's about at Penn State. And so he's going county by county and doing park surveys within some of the state parks. And so we are working on developing sort of a database of species lichens in Pennsylvania. And if you're interested in that, if you just Google the New York Botanical Gardens lichens, you might come up with their database. And they've got a nice database that has pictures and the species identification, where they're found. And so we are working our way in terms of getting all those through the state identified. But most of the counts or identifications are done on trees just because they are easier. The rocks do take a lot more time because of those chemical analyses. And soil is the same way.
Does this stuff grow on people's lawns too, or no? They just think it does.
I haven't seen it around here. But okay. if you go to areas like Canada, more areas that are much more rural, then you could probably see reindeer lichen up in Canada, people's yards. But I haven't really seen it. Yard. And there's one interesting point is there's actually one aquatic species of lichen, too, which is kind of cool. I haven't been able to find it yet, but apparently it does exist in Pennsylvania, but only in the very cleanest of streams. But that's kind of a neat species.
Kind of a two-part. The slow growth rate, does that make it easier or harder to use as an indicator? And the other thing is, at how long can an individual specimen live?
Okay. For the first question was looking at growth rates of lichens. We did do transplants. So we took them from Mingo Creek and transplanted them into Shenley Creek to compare growth rates at those two locations. We looked at a period of 1 year. All right. The problem we had was that we couldn't really discern any growth change within that 1 year because it's so slow. And one of the big things we saw was that a lot of those lichens were being broken up due to rainfall, due to limbs falling, just due to wind. And so in that case, we couldn't really develop any results from the study. So, yeah, it is hard. If you want to do something like looking at growth rates, Essentially, you need longer than a year, probably about 2 years or so. And the second one, I forgot what the second one was.
How long can the specimen live?
How long can they live? They can live up to hundreds of years. And in some cases, they've actually thought that in desert species, that species actually are thousands of years. So they can certainly live a very long time.
Yeah. Question over here?
Yeah.
I mean, how fragile is lichen? Like, if you step on it, does it come back easily, or do you spread it and help it grow?
Actually, I guess you could say both. But they are very fragile when they're dry, so it's very easy to break them off. But at the same time, you know, each of those little pieces, if it's got both the fungus and algae, and if they can attach to their own substrate, like a rock, you know, then they can grow again. So you have two answers to that. Yes, they're very fragile when they're dry. They can probably vegetatively reproduce on their own, those fragments. So you might actually be spreading them by stepping on them. So.
You said most species are edible.
Yeah.
And a few are poisonous. Any common characteristics of the poisonous ones?
yeah.
Not that I'm, you know, I ate earlier.
in this area, you can make a pretty good guess that about 90% of them are going to be edible. That's my guess, I should say, because I haven't come across any poisonous ones in Pennsylvania. But if you go to the West Coast, one thing to look for is any of the more hanging pendant ones, you probably want to stay away from. eating ones, probably not, you know, if you eat a little bit, it's not going to kill you, but it might give you a bit of a stomach ache. So it's not like some of the mushrooms where if you eat just even a small portion of that mushroom, you're done. You know? So there aren't too many that are actually poisonous. There's a very few of those, actually. And most of them are these hanging pendant ones. So that's one way to identify, just stay away from the hanging pendants. And they don't taste very good. Some people have asked me, it kind of just tastes like lettuce. although some, I guess, have some flavor, like that licorice one. But.
Question over here.
The research that you mentioned from Wetmore, where was his base data from the 1800s? What was he looking at to do a comparison?
He was looking at, I don't know who, but had done a survey of that area in the 1800s. So he was comparing essentially his data back to somebody else. But he also had the same problem in that he didn't know where the sites actually were that they identified the lichen. So he did just a park-wide survey. And he compared his total species count to what was back in the 1800s. So.
Do you feel comfortable that this was accurate? Or
he was comfortable with his identification, and to the best of his knowledge, you know, essentially you look at the ranges, because there's certainly it's difficult identifying these lichens. You can see the identification manual. Someone asked me, are there any good identification manuals? And it's really not. I mean, the only thing you can get is one of these big books where it asks for all these various chemical analyses and whatnot. So it can get pretty complex pretty quick. And back then, you know, they didn't really have these identification guides. There are some problems with comparing that data, certainly.
So when I was growing up, when I was a Cub Scout, if you can imagine that, short little chubby blue guy, we were taught that moss only grows on the north side of trees. Now, it sounds like this stuff grows all around, right?
Same thing with mosses, though.
Really?
Because they need sunlight just as much as mosses. But to be fair, there's also some species like shadow lichens that actually prefer the shady regions of trees.
Okay, I was wondering if I could blame it for that 3 days where I was wandering around in the forest moss. I guess I can't blame it on the... I was eating the wrong mushrooms. Okay.
Yeah, you're eating wolf lichen.
Any other questions, folks? If not, let's thank Dr. Updike for his great presentation tonight.
Thank you so much.
Let's thank his wife for the beautiful T-shirts that she designed and that gave out to us. Thank you very much, Heidi. And for bringing along all these neat samples to look at under a microscope. We've never had anybody do that for us before, so this was a real hands-on experience. We'd like you to join us again next month for our last event of the year, of the fiscal. That's not fiscal because we don't make any money. We're not even not for profit. We're below that for the season. Season. That's why I'm a writer. She comes up with the words. Our last event of the season, Misha Angrist. Dr. Misha Angrist will be speaking about genomics. Where is she from? He. Dr. Misha, he is a he. From the University of North Carolina, but originally from Pittsburgh. I forget these things, and Linda has to remind me all the time. But thank you all for coming. We hope to see you again in a month. It's always the first Monday of the month, June 6th. I really sound like I know what I'm talking about, don't I? I only had one glass of wine, so I apologize. But please join us for that, and we'll see you then. Linda has something to say.
For those of you who've been coming to the Marcellus Shale series, we have another program coming up later this month. Just please check the Science Center website for that information, and we'll look forward to seeing you then. Thanks very much.